This is the takeaway for Monday, July 31st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Did you watch Game of Thrones last night? There's a catchphrase from that show working its way around Washington lately. People watching the healthcare debate. They say,
"What is dead may never die.
What is dead may never die.
What is dead may never die." At least four times over the last few weeks, Republican attempts to get a healthcare policy have been declared dead in Washington. And every time a new version springs up in its place, lurches toward the Senate floor, only to die again. After last Thursday's stunning defeat, the Republican leader tried to finally bury his four attempts to pass an Obamacare repeal.
We look forward to our colleagues on the other side suggesting what they have in mind. So now, Mr. President, it's time to move on.
McConnell says Obamacare repeal is dead, and no sooner does he do that than the president takes to Twitter, ridicules Republicans for giving up, and then a group of GOP lawmakers, including Lindsey Graham, pops up at the White House, still trying to find a way to get the 50 votes that they need to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
What is dead may never die.
What is dead may never die.
What is dead may never die, indeed. There have been calls for a bipartisan path to try and fix Obamacare. John McCain says he wants it. Some other Republicans say they're willing to at least sit with Democrats and listen. But Republicans and Democrats working together on the most partisan issue in a hyper-partisan age? Could Lindsey Graham and his friends find a way that Mitch McConnell couldn't to pass repeal? Right now, Republicans' number one political promise appears dead. But maybe it's too important to be allowed to ever really die. Joanne Kennan is the executive editor for healthcare at Politico, and she joins me now on the state of the Obamacare repeal zombie, whether it lives or dies, and whether bipartisan healthcare is a creature that real-world Washington is ever likely to see.
There are a number of pathways forward, including just struggling for the votes, which is what the president kept tweeting over the weekend. They don't have the votes, but whether they try to come up with another partisan approach, whether they do something much smaller and declare victory, or whether they'd switch to a whole different approach involving greater state flexibility or this elusive thing that they used to call bipartisanship, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of these possibilities here. And we'll start with Lindsey Graham and friends, who I mentioned, who rushed over to the White House right after the latest defeat and tried to give a glimmer of hope to Republican partisan efforts to do this alone. What are they talking about?
Basically involves taking the revenue that comes in to finance Obamacare and basically giving it to the states and saying, you figure it out. It's a variant of another proposal by Senator Collins and Senator Cassidy that had been floating around in the background for a while and never really got any traction. So the Graham plan is in the spotlight today. Whether it gains traction or whether it falls apart, too soon to tell.
And while all this happens, Mitch McConnell, of course, says it's time to move on. He just watches from his perch in the Senate and says, if you all can come up with something, I'll entertain the idea. What's his strategy here? Or is he truly finished?
Remember that he thought the bill was dead. And then they actually did get it to the floor. And then at 1:30 in the morning on Friday, he lost it. So he's really not in a good mood. So he's taking stock. I don't think he wants the Senate to stay stuck on it. I think he would like to move on to tax reform and some other issues. I think if there was a deal that let them move forward, I don't think he'd block it. But he said he doesn't want just to give money to the insurance companies and call it a victory.
And the idea of giving money to insurance companies, Joe and Kennan, is getting increasingly important. There's these cost-sharing reductions that insurance companies rely on to keep many of the exchanges going. The president has some control over that money and has now threatened in more ways than one to cut off the tap, basically taking the approach that if Republicans in Congress can't repeal Obamacare, he'll simply work to undermine it.
It's not just undermining, it's blowing it up. These subsidies help lower-income people pay their out-of-pocket costs, their deductibles, their co-pays. You know, when they go to the doctor, they don't have to shell out the money. The insurers have to pay it. It's around $7 or $8 billion a year, and they have to pay it, and the government is supposed to reimburse them. Well, there's been a fight between Congress and originally the Obama administration over that money. The Obama administration was paying it. The Congress said that they hadn't approved those payments. It's pending in court. The first round of that court case actually went to the Republicans in the House. The White House has continued to pay them. But Trump pretty much every month says, you know, I don't really want to pay them. And that's really become very, very, very loud in the last few days. The president apparently believes that he stops the subsidies, Obamacare goes into a real crisis. He thinks the Democrats would then, you know, have to come and cut a deal with him. That's far from clear. Meanwhile, if he does stop them, as he's threatening to do, some of the insurers would just say, okay, I've had it. I'm out of here. I'm not going to stay in the markets next year. Others might stay in, but they would then raise their premiums even more to make up for that $8 billion or $7 billion that they're counting on and that the government spigot may turn off. We've been told, Kellyanne Conway said it on TV on Sunday, the decision would come this week, possibly today or tomorrow. It may be that his advisors talk him down and say, well, you know, there's this new proposal by Senator Graham. Let's look at that. Let's see if we can make that work. That might buy some time, whether it is part of some kind of bipartisan fix that we're not there yet. But there are some preliminary, I wouldn't say robust, high-level conversations about bipartisanship, but there's some conversations. It's hard to get there, though, right? I mean, if you've been screaming at each other at the top of your lungs for 7 years, it's really hard to say, oh, let's go do this together in a nice bipartisan way. They need a little time to take their breath and regroup and try to find a path, if they can find that path.
So, Joanne, what realistically does bipartisanship look like now that there's a couple senators saying they're willing to at least have the conversation?
There are a couple of senators in public saying that, and there are also some people talking behind the scenes, and there's also a group of about 40 Republicans and Democrats, centrists on the House side, that are having conversations that today are releasing a plan that Politico reported last night. I mean, it's just a very preliminary, here's some basic ideas to move us forward, and that group themselves can't make this happen, but it's a starting point. And it is including these cost-sharing subsidies would continue. There would be some form of stabilization funds for the insurers, either through the states or whatever mechanism they choose. So what is that magic formula where both sides can say, okay, we fixed it. Neither one of them are really happy, but both of them can live with it. And Obamacare becomes less fragile. That it, you know, in some states it works well, in some states it's not working well. It does work better than its critics say. I mean, I can see a pathway toward a bipartisan deal. You know, I can see anything from Trump pulling out this sort of, you know, financial grenade and stopping things and really blowing it up to some kind of quiet discussions that do lead to some kind of bipartisan solution that would probably involve some degree of moving the control and decisions from Washington up to a point to the states.
Joanne Kennan, executive editor for healthcare at Politico. Thanks a lot.
Great to be here.
Russian President Vladimir Putin announced on Sunday that he's forcing America's diplomatic mission in Moscow to downsize by more than 750 people. It's the latest swing in a series of blows between Russia and the United States. Putin is responding to new sanctions from Congress, retaliation for actions that included Russia's interference in the 2016 election. The Trump administration tried to stop those sanctions from passing, but Congress overwhelmingly approved them. And now the president is out of options. Rajan Menon is here with more on this diplomatic escalation. He's the Ann and Bernard Spitzer professor at the Powell School at the City College of New York. And he says after the sanctions vote last week, Putin's answer wasn't surprising.
The cutting of the embassy staff, I wouldn't characterize as a significant escalation because it's kind of a tit for tat. You may remember that in December, President Obama expelled 35 Russian diplomats and brought the Russian representation in the United States to 455. So the 755 number that Putin has reduced by brings their representation and ours on par.
All right, but if the Russians are signaling that they have to respond to sanctions and signaling that they're out of patience with the United States, there's an irony here. President Trump has made so many efforts to flatter Vladimir Putin, to praise him, of course, to signal a willingness not for new sanctions, but to lift existing sanctions. He's refused to name Russia in election meddling. So given all of this, the relationship has still managed to deteriorate. Why has that happened?
Well, Trump's election, as it turned out, has not been the boon for Russia that most people in the United States, commentators, etc., have thought it would be. In fact, Russia has become such an albatross around Mr. Trump's neck that anything he does in terms of sanctions relief or cozying up to Russia becomes a political liability for him. So what these sanctions have done is to make it impossible or nearly impossible for him to lift sanctions without congressional approval. And I've just read the bill, and it's pretty airtight. So even if Mr. Trump wanted to, he cannot lift the sanctions. He can't even lift the sanctions that President Obama imposed in 2014 and 15 and 16. Those were executive orders, which Mr. Obama or Mr. Trump could have lifted with the stroke of a pen, but they now have been rolled into legislation, as have the more recent extensive sanctions.
So that might mean then that Vladimir Putin looks at President Trump, and even though he was full of nice words and signals that he wanted to warm up relations or get close to Vladimir Putin, he's seeing a president that doesn't have the power anymore to do it.
No question. The Russian media's coverage of Trump has become much less favorable, and Russian officials, including Mr. Putin, have signaled that they are disappointed and expect things to get worse before they'll get better. So certainly there is a sense of disappointment on the Russian side.
So President Trump was cornered here by Congress. He had Republicans and Democrats in Congress, as we've said on this show, who were pretty fed up with the president refusing publicly to take Russia seriously, refusing publicly to condemn Russia for meddling in the election. So they passed these sanctions. The president was cornered. Is there a chance here that Putin might think he overplayed his hand with Donald Trump and now has angered Congress so that things are more difficult?
Well, you know, from Putin's perspective, the Russian line has been that they did not meddle in the elections, and that Trump's election had to do with the preference of the American people. So I don't think Putin will ever say he overplayed his hand. That said, although the Russians, in my view, were not expecting Trump to be elected any more than we were, once he was, I think they had reason to expect, certainly compared to what Hillary Clinton might have done, that there would be an uptick and a rapprochement between Russia and the United States. That almost certainly will not happen as far as the eye can see.
Well, are there opportunities to improve on this relationship?
Not for the short term. So take the words of Senate Minority Schumer, Leader Schumer, who was very instrumental in getting these sanctions passed. He said, now Congress, not the president, becomes the, quote, final arbiter of when sanctions relief will occur, and that any chance that the president can lift the sanctions have been, quote, dashed by this legislation. So Mr. Trump is handcuffed, and Mr. Putin knows Mr. Trump is handcuffed.
But then, Rajan Menon, that's an extraordinary state of affairs where Congress has wrested control of diplomacy with an adversary, an important adversary like Russia, from the hands of the president.
Absolutely. That is why Mr. Trump and Mr. Tillerson made it very clear before the legislation passed that they were not in favor of it, because traditionally, whether it's Mr. Trump or another president, they like maximum flexibility in terms of dealing with foreign countries. And this legislation, essentially on the question of Russia sanctions, puts Congress in the driver's seat and not the president.
Rajan Menon, professor at the Powell School at the City College of New York, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway. And we have a story now about what can happen when a ruling from Washington on the fundamentals of justice reaches the 50 states. The Supreme Court ruled in 2016 that juveniles can no longer be sentenced to life in prison without parole. After that, the justices went further, and they said that current juvenile sentences could be up for review. Thousands of inmates around the country are now getting their sentences reviewed as a result. And even though they were convicted as juveniles, some of them have served more than 50 years. The Associated Press is launching a three-part series now examining how states are heading in different directions when it comes to handling these cases and exposing a system that can often seem arbitrary when courts decide who gets out of prison and who stays locked up for life. Sharon Cohen is a national writer for the Associated Press, and she brings us the story of Bobby Hines, who's up for parole in September.
Bobby Hines was a 15-year-old Detroit kid back in 1989 when he and two other teenagers went over to confront a young man over a friend's stolen jacket. And in the course of that, the 21-year-old man, James Warren, was killed. Bobby was not the shooter, and he did not have the gun, but he was charged and convicted of mandatory life without parole. So at 15, he faced the rest of his life in prison. And he rejected a plea at the time of 20 to 40 years. He ended up serving more time than the two people who were with him. One was the shooter and one who had supplied the gun.
And how long of a sentence did Bobby Hines serve?
Bobby Hines has been in prison more than 27 years. He faced a resentencing that made him eligible for parole. He had a hearing before a parole board, and he is set to be released in September.
So Bobby Hines and his case sound like prime examples of the type of case that the Supreme Court was talking about in their recent ruling that told states and jurisdictions to go back and reconsider the sentences for inmates who were convicted to life without parole as juveniles. How has that ruling affected his case?
Well, that gave him the opportunity for a resentencing. And his case was particularly interesting because the sister and the father of the victim both appeared on his behalf and urged that he be released. And that's pretty unusual.
So we've been covering the Supreme Court's ruling, Sharon Cohen, on this show with stories similar to Bobby Hines and inmates in other jurisdictions around the country. And those differences sound like they're really important because after the order from the Supreme Court's justices, it seems like different states are implementing the ruling and doing resentencing at very different rates under very different criteria. Can you talk about that?
There's a patchwork of justice. So the impact of the Supreme Court decision varies from county to county. And a lot of the prosecutors in Michigan, for example, are seeking new no-parole sentences for all or most of their juvenile lifers. In other states, in Pennsylvania, they're moving along. They've resentenced about 100 or more of their more than 500 inmates. So the justice system is working in different ways. And in some places, prosecutors don't want the release of their inmates, and others, they're amenable to resentencings. In Wayne County, for example, in Detroit, the prosecutor there has been open to resentencing in more than half of their cases. In other counties, in the neighboring county, only 5 of 49 cases are eligible for resentencing. So some prosecutors are taking a very hard line on this. Others are not. And they're difficult cases because there's victim families to consider. There's the question of rehabilitation. And in some places, defense attorneys say that prosecutors are just flouting the Supreme Court's laws by not focusing on the rare offender. They're trying to resentence everybody.
But does this mean that the implementation, the fulfilling of the Supreme Court's order is going prosecutor by prosecutor, county by county, and not even state by state? Are individual prosecutors responsible for fulfilling what the justices said?
In many of these cases, what you're finding is the first cases that are coming before to be resentenced and going before parole boards are those cases in which prosecutors and defense attorneys have agreed to a term of years. In other words, they've found some kind of agreement, and they will propose that to the judge. The cases that have not been heard in Michigan and in some in Pennsylvania are the cases where they are seeking life without parole again. So those are the tougher ones, and those are going to come up ahead. And we haven't heard from those in Michigan yet, because there's a Supreme Court, Michigan Supreme Court case that's to decide whether judges or juries will hear those cases. So the cases we're seeing now go before the courts are the ones where there's often some kind of agreement between the defense attorney and the prosecutor on a recommended sentence, and then they will go before the judge. So there's a lot of the tougher ones still to come.
And what kind of factors are those defense attorneys and prosecutors considering, or the judges considering, when they get a deal or recommend a new sentence? What kind of factors are they considering in that inmate when that inmate was a kid?
They look at the crime. They look at the circumstances of the crime. They look at how the inmate is done in prison. Did he or she get a GED? Did he have a good work record? What is his rehabilitation? They look at mental health records as well. And then on the other side, the defense is arguing that in many of these cases, these were 14, 15, 16-year-olds who deserve a second chance, that what they were then is not what they are now.
Bobby Hines was 15 when he helped commit this crime and was convicted. How did he do in prison for all these years? He was there by the time he was an adolescent and a young adult, and he spent so many years since.
He did pretty well. At the beginning, he had a record for violations that involved fighting, but then he settled down. He got his GED. He had a very good work record. He was not a problem inmate. So as he got older, he did well. And that was one of the things that was mentioned in the court hearing.
Michigan moving in a patchwork fashion to implement the orders of the Supreme Court when it comes to juveniles convicted to life in prison without parole. Sharon Cohen of the Associated Press, thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It was a violent day of voting in Venezuela yesterday. Citizens went to the polls to pick delegates for a new constituent assembly. It's tasked with rewriting Venezuela's constitution, and it's widely seen as part of President Nicolas Maduro's plan to strengthen his party's power. Maduro's move sparked months of protest and political opposition from those who fear that the country is headed for a dictatorship. Protests yesterday killed several people, including one pro-government candidate for the Constituent Assembly. Anatoly Kermanayev is a Wall Street Journal reporter in Venezuela, and he says it's increasingly hard to distinguish what's behind the various acts of violence.
The Attorney General's office says 10 people died in the unrest, including one candidate in the eastern state of Bolivar. Keep in mind that Venezuela is a very dangerous, violent country, normally a second highest homicide rate, according to UN. So it's often very difficult to separate what's protest-related, what's political violence from general unrest in the country. This is especially true in the provinces where most of the deaths occur because there's very little independent media left, there's a lot of paramilitary activities, a lot of intimidation, so very little evidence, recorded evidence of what's going on. But we can tell for sure that this was a very violent day, and in fact, the most deadly election in Venezuela's recent history.
And this candidate for the Constituent Assembly who was killed, Anatoly, do we have any indication that person was targeted because of politics?
No, we don't have any indication that this would happen. So far, early signs show that this was a robbery, a garden variety of robbery. As I said, thousands of people, tens of thousands of people die here in gang-related violence here every year. There has been violence on both sides. Many National Guardsmen, policemen, shot dead by protesters. But the vast bulk of the violence has come from pro-government groups, from security forces, just because the firepower is so unequal. The government controls, of course, all the arsenal. You know, for every death of a pro-government candidate, it's been about 10 to 15 death of opposition supporters, which of course doesn't justify any violence whatsoever, but does make you realize just how uneven the playing field is here in Venezuela.
So this new Constituent Assembly is just about in place. It was almost a foregone conclusion at this point. Opponents see it as a way for Maduro to tailor make the Constitution to his liking and extend his power. Is there an off-ramp to this situation now that he's pushing ahead?
The important thing about what happened yesterday in Venezuela is that for the first time the government just made up a number. I mean, this is unprecedented, and the shock in developments. The socialist governments of Venezuela, you know, they've been ruling for 18 years, and they have won more than a dozen elections. As years went by, they increasingly resorted to changing the playing field, to intimidating opponents, to changing dates, etc. But when the election day came, these elections were always valid, and people always expressed their will. The government has crossed a very important Rubicon. You know, we are no longer talking about the troubled democracy. This is now, well, I suppose dictatorship is the only word left. So you know, there's a lot at stake here now, and a lot will depend on what will happen in the next week or two.
So Anatoly Kermanayev, you mentioned that the next week or two are critically important. What are you looking for?
Well, as early as today, President Trump is meant to announce new economic sanctions. The important thing to look for is what happens behind the scenes. The opposition and the government, they are meant to work out some sort of agreement now. How this new assembly going to work? When is it going to take office? Where is it physically going to be based? Whether they will dissolve other institutions against them? All this will now be under negotiation, and that's where the real political transition will come in Venezuela.
Anatoly Kermanayev, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Anatoly Kermanayev is with the Wall Street Journal in Venezuela. $21 million people are victims of human trafficking worldwide, and nearly a third of them are children. Sunday was World Day Against Trafficking in Persons. It's supposed to raise awareness of modern slavery around the globe. Governments talk about combating human trafficking all the time, but sometimes liberation is local. One rescued child, one prosecuted trafficker, and one person at a time. Michael Brzozowski is president and founder of Blue Dragon Children's Foundation. That's an organization based in Hanoi, Vietnam, and it's rescued close to 700 people from trafficking. Trafficking is on the rise in Vietnam. Brzozowski says that's because it's an extremely lucrative industry, and it's not easy to stop.
Human trafficking is an unusual crime. It's constantly evolving and adapting, and it's very hard for law enforcement to get out ahead of it. Traffickers change the way they work all the time to stay one step ahead. So, you know, being such an agile crime and being so lucrative, I think it's an easy one for bad guys to get into.
Can you take us inside then what would amount to an operation?
First of all, we respond to calls for help. That call may come to us from a family member. Their daughter has called them from China and said, you know, Mom, help me. And so the family will contact us. And the first step will be investigation, trying to pin down where she is, what city she's in. And once we've located her, we don't confront. We don't fight the traffickers. We're not kicking doors down. Our expertise, Todd, is in setting up an escape. We will find a way to help her get out of there, and then we'll run and bring her back to Vietnam.
So what you're saying is getting her out of the situation quickly, quietly, and safely is the MO.
That's right. And once we're back at the border between China and Vietnam, we then work with the police on both sides to facilitate a legal crossing. And that way, both sides have a record of this crime, and they can then go after the traffickers and bring down the trafficking ring.
So that's the next part of the dilemma, of course. There's no dilemma in rescuing a person that needs help, but leaving behind a known criminal enterprise and other people who are clearly being victimized, and you have to make that decision.
That's right. That's right. Now, we don't always know what happens then, because then it becomes a police matter. But we do know that on the Vietnamese side, nearly all of our cases now are resulting in arrests and prosecutions. So the case doesn't end once we've rescued that person. We make sure, as far as possible, that this results in a prosecution. And that brings down the whole trafficking ring. So it's not only one person who we're rescuing.
Well, I know a lot of the work that you do is quiet and clandestine and quick. It seems like it would be a good thing if traffickers in Vietnam started to get the idea that Blue Dragon and others like you are out there. And there's a pretty big risk in participating in this kind of activity because you might be waiting across the street.
That is exactly right. The whole point of what we're doing is raising the risk and raising the cost of trafficking. A few years ago, when we first started coming across the issue of men sexually abusing homeless boys here in Hanoi, they were doing that with absolute impunity. There was no risk that anyone would stop them, arrest them. Now, we've worked with the local police to get about 6 people arrested and sentenced to prison. Now the word is out. This might happen to you. And so that has really stopped people in their tracks. And whereas a few years ago, boys were being sexually abused even in parks out in the open, that has really had to stop. If there's no risk, if they've never heard of anybody being caught, then they're not going to be afraid. And we need them to be afraid.
Are you well funded? Are you set to grow?
We're hoping to grow. This year, we're looking at how we can create new partnerships, especially with business, that will mean we can keep growing. We've had a huge growth in the last year of calls for help from trafficked people. And we can't say no. When that phone rings and someone is saying, please help me, we can't say, look, I'm sorry, you know, we've run out of money. So that's a real pressure for us. But if we get that right, we can do a lot of good.
Michael Brzozowski, good luck.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to talk to you.
Michael Brzozowski is founder and president of Blue Dragon Children's Foundation. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The chemical industry is notoriously secretive. Rules governing what chemical companies can sell and how safe their products have to be can be complicated and opaque. Now, activists have released tens of thousands of documents detailing how chemical companies operate behind the scenes. They're known as the poison papers, and the people who publish them say they represent a running timeline of fraudulent science and regulatory collusion between pesticide companies and the government. The documents were published by the Biosciences Resources Project and a watchdog group called the Center for Media and Democracy. Dr. Jonathan Latham is executive director of the Biosciences Resource Project, and he says the evidence of collusion is clear.
It weighs 3.5 tons almost, and it is approximately 20,000 documents. So these documents are anything from letters to lengthy reports. And what it covers is the activities of the chemical industry roughly between the late 60s primarily and the middle 90s. It basically covers issues like chemical contamination with dioxins, which has to do with Agent Orange. It has to do with herbicide spraying. It has to do with PCBs that are in many, many waterways and states are suing about. And it has to do with pesticides in general.
And how many chemical companies are we talking about included in the documents?
Pretty much every chemical company that existed at that time.
What's shown in these documents about how not only companies handled what they knew about the toxicity of these chemicals, but also how the government handled it?
Well, you know, what's really interesting about these documents is how the government handles all these issues. So, you know, the main protagonist in this is the EPA because they're responsible for chemical safety. And what you see is persistent efforts by the EPA to resist the knowledge that many of these chemicals are extremely dangerous. When EPA staffers, for example, report on hazards to their superiors, the superiors don't want to do anything about it. Or when they find that fraudulent testing has been submitted to them, they don't want to do anything about it. Because basically, if you have to do something about it, you have to pass it up the line. And eventually, up the line means to the senior administrator of the EPA, and then they have to have the president standing behind them if they actually want to take decisive action against a toxic chemical or a series of toxic chemicals. And everyone knows that's not going to happen. And so basically, bad news doesn't travel in the agency, and so you end up with a closet full of skeletons, and that's what is in those papers.
Well, let's get specific about an instance or two. What are some of the most disturbing revelations that you saw when it came to a lack of desire or an inability to regulate something that everybody knew was dangerous?
I mean, there's some classic documents in those papers. So, for example, there is the transcript of a meeting that took place between senior EPA people and basically all the representatives of the chemical industry. They allow two representatives of each chemical company. And basically, the meeting was to decide what to do about a chemical testing fraud that had been discovered by FDA. And it became public knowledge, and so EPA had to do something about the fact that a chemical company, testing company called IBT, was submitting fraudulent tests. You know, big companies like Monsanto were basically submitting all their testing through this company, and it was responsible for 30 or 40% of all chemical safety testing that was going on in the country at the time. And, you know, the consequences of throwing out all these tests was enormous. And so EPA met the chemical companies and they said, we'll kick the can down the road and give you a chance to resubmit studies and so forth. In the meanwhile, you're not telling the public that the chemicals that they're using in their households and yards and are in their food basically have completely unsound tests behind them. In some cases, 100% of the chemical tests were unsound.
Is there any way to know how many people might have been sickened or even died because of it?
We're talking about a very large number of people. I mean, we know that many of these chemicals reduce people's IQ, for example. So we know that these chemicals are present in the food supply and in the environment at levels in which they're likely to explain the cancer epidemics, the mental health problems, and many other illnesses that we have.
Well, these hundreds of thousands of documents that we're talking about come from mostly one person named Carol von Strum. Who is Carol von Strum, and how did she come to accumulate all of this material that's so damning to so many corporations and also to regulators?
The story began when her family was sprayed from the air by forest sprayers in Oregon. And, you know, what they started noticing was fish dying. Their children became sick. They became sick. The neighbors reported that they were sick. And basically, they were being sprayed with Agent Orange. You know, a lot of these documents come from FOIA requests. So herself and her husband were basically chasing up all the different lines of evidence. And they persuaded the EPA to do testing. And they were finding high levels of dioxins and other chemicals and knowing full well that in large part they came from this testing program. And yet they sat on this data and in many cases denied that it existed.
Do you anticipate any major reforms, any changes in policy now that the public and lawmakers are going to be able to see the depth of the fraud that's been going on?
You know, there are some things that we would really like to see come out of this. You know, there's evidence, for example, that 2,4-D that Dow makes contains dioxins. The companies and EPA have already always been in denial that many pesticides on the market today still contain dioxins. But, you know, there's a systemic problem here. If you think about the structure of the EPA, right, it's basically judge, jury, prosecutor, and rulemaker all at the same time for toxic chemicals. It has basically complete power over the system. And so basically what would need to be done is to remove the internal institutional conflicts of interest. You know, the moment, most people think, oh, if I only ban this one chemical, that things will improve. But if the system is wrong, then any replacement chemical is likely to have just as many or more problems with it as the old one did. And so you end up on a pesticide treadmill in which neonicotinoids are replacing organophosphates, which replace DDT, which replace lead arsenic. And basically all these substitutes, each one is arguably worse than the ones that came before.
Dr. Jonathan Latham is executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, which co-published the poison papers. Dr. Latham, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
We reached out to the EPA for a comment on this story. We haven't heard back as of Monday morning. Across generations, his roles have been iconic.
You're going to learn to say your name. Let me hear you say it. What's your name?
Kunta. Kunta Kinte.
It's not fair, Doc. I've never seen a rainbow.
Take a look. It's in a book. A reading rainbow.
LeVar Burton is here. He's known to millions of people as the host of Reading Rainbow, also the star of the original Roots, Geordi LaForge on Star Trek The Next Generation. He's also the host of a new podcast, LeVar Burton Reads. LeVar Burton, welcome.
Thanks, Todd. How you feeling?
I'm feeling good. It's been a few years since we've had you on the show. Yeah. What have you been up to?
The business of Reading Rainbow, making good on the promises that we made during the Kickstarter in 2014. We raised about $6 million to expand the digital footprint that we had established with the relaunch of Reading Rainbow. And we were able to, thanks to the success of the Kickstarter, get from the iPad to other devices, Androids, Kindles, the web, and develop a product specifically for teachers to use in the classrooms, an EDU product that I'm really, really proud of.
So there are millions of adults, hopefully lots of them listening to us right now, who've spent a lot of hours with you over their lifetimes and in their childhoods with Reading Rainbow. They're big readers now, just as you intended, right? That was the point.
That was the point.
And now you have your podcast where LeVar Burton reads, but it's not for little kids.
No, this is content for adults. I've been asked many, many times over the years. My wife has hounded me relentlessly. When are you going to start creating content for adults? And I'd had my eye on the podcasting space. And during the last 5 years, when I've really been focused on this business of Reading Rainbow, I discovered last year that I just really needed something creative that I did simply for the joy of it.
Hi, I'm LeVar Burton, and this is LeVar Burton Reads. In every episode, I handpick a different piece of short fiction and read it to you.
The podcast is what came out of that desire.
Tell me what it's like. Tell me the kinds of books that you choose and what it means to read to adults.
Well, I'm a huge fan of short fiction, Todd. Read a lot of it and started reading short fiction when I was a kid with Ring Lardner and O. Henry. And my love of short fiction has really carried over into my my adult life. And I wanted to share that love, because I think short stories are really, they're not easy to write. To have a compelling, tell a compelling tale with a beginning, a middle, and an end in, you know, 30, 40 pages is no small task. And so there's a certain mastery that is inherent in the best of short fiction. And so what I do is I pick a short story for every episode and I read it.
Mrs. Whittaker found the Holy Grail. It was under a fur coat. Every Thursday afternoon, Mrs. Whittaker walked down to the post office to collect her pension, even though her legs were no longer what they were. And on the way back home, she would stop in at the Oxfam shop and buy herself a little something.
We sweeten that reading with, you know, some tasty music and sound effects and create sort of an immersive experience for the listener.
You have spent thousands of hours reading for kids, that kind of performance.
Mm-hmm.
How is it different reading for adults?
It's not, really. Hmm. It's
I mean, that's it.
It's the same. Everyone loves being read to, I believe. And part of the pleasure of this podcast for me is that we seem to be reminding adults that, you know, my life is so busy and I've stopped reading, and this reminds me either to read more or to just enjoy literature in some way, shape, or form. And that's pretty cool.
Get some storytelling
yeah.
into your daily routine, in other
right,
words.
Right, exactly.
Look, in some ways it's easier to read than ever before. You can take your Kindle with you. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
In other ways, we're distracted, I think in ways that are obvious and maybe not reading as much.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think we are now?
We're in uncharted territory, I believe, because of the reasons you cited. We are obsessed, addicted to these devices. And that genie's not going to go back in the bottle. That ship has sailed. And yes, along with the technology comes an ease of use and a convenience that is unparalleled. I carry a library around with me on my iPad. That is a miracle to me. Never before possible in the history of humanity have you been able to carry around as many books as I do, as we all do, on our digital devices. And that's just something we're going to need to adapt to in terms of how do we continue to conduct ourselves in a civilized manner, to continue to respect ourselves and respect the space of others while we have these devices in front of our faces, oftentimes at the exclusion of all else.
When you do the podcast, LeVar, are you reading off an iPad or from the printed word?
Printed word.
From the book?
Mostly, yes. Although I'm not. Look, I don't care if you're reading from a digital device or from a printed book. I simply want y'all to read. That's my deal. Okay.
So in a lot of ways, it strikes me, LeVar Burton, this new podcast. I mean, this is a library for your ears, right? Books on tape aren't new. Anybody can get that. You can't necessarily get LeVar Burton reading it to you, which makes you feel like that Reading Rainbow kid all over again. And I think maybe that's what a lot of us love about this. But this is sort of a library in your earbuds, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's snackable content. The stories range from, you know, 35 to 45 minutes. So on a commute or while you're doing the dishes, you know, you can listen to a story and get lost in the storytelling.
There was a small metal finger ring, unornamented, tied to the handle of the lamp with brown twine. "Actually," said Mrs. Whittaker, "on second thoughts, I think I'll just have the book."
The podcast is LeVar Burton Reads. He's here to read to you as an adult. This is not Reading Rainbow, or is it? I'm not really sure. LeVar Burton is the host of it. He's also the actor who you know, the star of Roots, Jordy LaForge, and our friend here on The Takeaway. LeVar Burton, thank you.
Todd, as always, a pleasure.
And we've heard from so many of you with your memories of childhood reading.
This is Samantha from Atlanta, Georgia. In the summer before I started kindergarten, my dad read me The Hobbit in his beautiful baritone. My mom also read to us, but that book sticks out because my dad didn't get a lot of time with us, and it established me as a lover of tales of fantasy in general.
This is Gwen from Auburn, Massachusetts. My mom bought the Dandelion Library
They had two stories to each hardcover. She would read one story, then turn it over to read the other one. I remember her reading Babar stories to us. Wonderful memories.
Hi, this is Anne. I'm calling from Oberlin. The book that sticks in my mind is A Wrinkle in Time, because the characters let me see beyond social limits and is an awkward adolescent. It's helped me.
This is Renee KB in Chicago. My dad read Old Yeller to us. I don't remember the story, but I cherish the memory of his voice.
This is Erin from Southampton, and as a child I loved every Dr. Seuss book, particularly Green Eggs and Ham. My father read it to me so many times that even now, as a 46-year-old, I can still recite lines with him and will often text passages from the book to one another. It's really one of the fondest memories I have of childhood reading.
Great memories from you on the books from your childhood. We want to hear more of your memories. If you haven't yet, give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting The Incredible Jessica James, a new romantic comedy starring Jessica Williams and Chris O'Dowd, now streaming on Netflix.
PRI, Public Radio International.